Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this third week lectures of Applied Time Series Analysis. I heard that you had some difficulties in the recording activities during the demonstrations number two. So for those parts that you seem to be experiencing difficulties in running the codes by yourself, please be in contact with Juho-Matti and Alexandra, if you have any problems with those. It was a technical problem at that time that some of the demonstration questions or the demo parts were not recorded, but these things are like nowadays, so we are living these hard times and nothing is normal, so anything can basically happen. Let's hope that this time we are able to continue and do this lecture without any problems. Okay, so let's start today from the discussion of multivariate models for stationary variables. So we have been already, during the first week, we discussed about basic ideas of linear regression models in general, which means that those kind of analysis and tools you can apply, for example, to a set of variables. And last week we concentrated on univariate time series analysis, which means that basically we try to somehow capture the time trends or the effects of the past observations on the current observations using so-called technical or structural univariate time series analysis. And this week we will be extending that discussion, that basically you can analyze these kind of AR type models in a multivariate setting. That is that you can basically apply these autoregressive type models to a set of variables that is based on your economic or financial theory. So remember to always have in mind when you do any kind of analysis using empirical data set that you should always have some kind of theoretical model as the background for choosing your variables. What are the relevant variables? Why won't you analyze especially those variables? And what is the reason for assuming that one or more of those variables should be determined endogenously, so that the other variables have an effect on those endogenous variables? So usually the economic or financial theory gives you clear ideas about that. So basically also some kind of ideas about the causality in time series dimension between those variables should be based on your theoretical approach. You have an idea that a shock in some variable should have an effect on other variables, and you're interested about that. One of the key things here that we assume for the data generating processes of the individual univariate time series is that they are stationary. And we already discussed about the stationarity, idea of stationarity, very briefly last week. And in, for example, case of simple AR models, you get an idea about stationarity or not of the variable when you have estimated the parameter estimate on the first lagged observations. If they are close to one, then you are basically in troubles. You might not have a stationary time series. And we will be, this week we will be discussing about the problems in these kind of data generating processes. But let's now first take a look at the background or the reasons for focusing especially on the endogeneity and exogeneity of the variables in a multivariate setting. So in this case, when we have more than one variable under analysis, we are discussing about a system of equations. And the problem is in most cases that it can be the case that even though based on the theory, we would have an idea that certain variables have explanatory power to other variables, and we can basically, for example, define one equation to be resembling the demand conditions in the markets, and the second equation would be describing the supply conditions of the markets. But basically, the main problem is there that we only have same kind of data for the interesting quantities like amount of supply or demand, so that the quantity of good that we are interested about and the price of the good. We cannot say that it is a demand price or it is a supply price or it is the demand quantity or supply quantity if the markets are in equilibrium. In that case, the conditions are met so that there's no excess demand, so there's no excess supply in the markets, and the markets are in equilibrium. So up until now, we have been focusing only last week during last week lectures to the single equation models of this kind of representation. Also, the OLS regression analysis was based on using only one equation for the variables. But now we are extending these two words more than one equation. So basically, this is also already a vector representation. So basically, we may have only one equation for the dependent variable, and we have a set of information explaining the behavior of the dependent variable. So the set of information, conditioning information, refers here to this X vector of explanatory variables. And we assume that all the variables that are included to this vector of explanatory variables are assumed to be exogenous. And the only variable that we are assuming to be endogenous is this Y. Now, we are extending this actually simply to a case where we have more than one variable on the left-hand side. And we might have same set of information to explain also the other variables like Y1 and Y2, but that X vector could actually in some equation contain also other information that is being used in the first equation for the Y1. So that is a set of equation. And we may have simultaneity in the set of or the system of equations. So they are, their values are determined contemporaneously. So they are at the same time determined based on the conditioning information. But the theory, economic or financial theory, should give you a priori an idea about the relevant information in the X. So it can be assumed to be behaving like a set of exogenous variables. So from an economic literature, a very simple example about these system of equations is this demand and supply of a good. So the first equation here is referring to the demand equation, and the second equation is referring to the supply. And note that these are time series. So we are explaining, for example, quarterly observations of the supply of Nokia mobile phones, for example. So we have a demand equation also for those. And in the demand equation, we have first explanatory variable or information is a constant term. And we can say that in the demand equation, it might be different than in the supply equation. So alpha might be different compared to lambda. The first actual explanatory variable in the demand equation is the price of the Nokia phones. Then we have also a second variable here, a time series of the prices of, let's say, for example, Huawei phones with similar characteristics in other terms. Then much of the things are being left explained about the demand of Nokia phones. So everything that's been unexplained here is captured by this error term UT. Then we have the supply equation. In the supply equation, we assume that it doesn't have to be the case that the there is some constant part of the supplied amount that should be same as in the demand equation. But nevertheless, we have relevant information once again regarding the prices. Supply of Nokia phones is also depending on the prices of the Nokia phone. So a priori, based on economic theory, basically we have some ideas about the size of the parameter estimates, for example. Can anyone tell me if the Nokia phones nowadays can be denoted to be so-called normal goods? What would be expect based on economic theory for the sign of this beta parameter here in the demand equation? Is the effect of rising prices of Nokia phones, is it positive or negative on the demand? Just open your microphone. Even without knowing any intermediate microeconomic theory, you should have an idea intuitively already that if the price of the Nokia phones is increasing, would the demand increase or would it be lower? Would it decrease?
It would decrease, of course.
Yeah, of course. If we are assuming that the Nokia phones are nowadays considered as a normal good, that's one of the basic background assumptions. So the parameter estimate for the regression model, where you have quantities for Nokia phones, time series of those, and then time series of the prices, and time series of the substitute good. So time series of the Huawei prices. The beta parameter based on standard economic theory should be negative. And we are interested about the significance in statistical terms of this beta parameter. Does it get to be estimated with the right theoretical sign? And moreover, can we estimate it so precisely that the standard error of the parameter estimate is small enough that based on the amount of observation, number of observations, we can say that it is statistically significantly negative. It's different from zero. But the problem is that we have this price and quantity data in the market equilibrium as individual variables or time series. We cannot say that it is the demanded or it is supplied exactly, but because it's in the market equilibrium, demand equals supply. So what can we say in this supply equation about the assumed sign of this mu parameter?
It's positive.
Yeah, it should be positive based on the standard economic theory. What about the size of these other guys here in the demand equation? What can you say about the assumed sign based on the standard economic theory of this gamma?
It's positive.
Yeah, it's positive because if the size, if the price of the substitute good Huawei phones increases, the demand for Nokia phones increases. And what about this technological state of technology variable in the supply equation? Let's assume that this is the increasing values of T are referring to better possibilities to produce more efficiently.
Positive.
Yeah, once again, positive. So these are the things that you, at the first stage of any kind of analysis, you would have to stop and figure out what does the theory say to you for the part of assuming the signs for these coefficients. And if you get wrong signs for this, then you might be getting those results based on the biases that you are actually now subject in your analysis based on this simultaneous equation biases. You are not able to define that what are these actually. Are these demand quantities or are these supply quantities or are these demand prices or are these demand supply prices? So this is actually very relevant for you. Stop here first. You have some kind of economic theory that a priori gives you ideas about the assumed parameter estimates. So based on the first stage estimations, take a look at the parameter estimates. You can basically estimate these separately using OLS. But after you have got the estimates, you are not able to say whether they are in connection to demand or supply, because the relevant variables are that you are interested about are these prices of the good that you are interested about. Obviously, these help you to identify, but if you estimate the equations without these additional clearly exogenous variables, so S is clearly exogenous to the demand equation for the quantity of Nokia phones, and T is clearly exogenous also here. So basically, you can, based on these additional variables, you can do identification to a degree. But if you don't have these, then you are in problems. You are not able to say whether it's a demand equation or is it a supply equation. This is the standard idea in all the multiple equation or multivariate analysis of multivariate systems. So take a good look at this and try to understand first these ideas. So let's assume now that the market always clears and drop now for simplicity the time subscripts. That was just for giving you the idea that you can really do this if you have the time series for these variables. You can do the estimations. So this is called a simultaneous structural form of the model. Why structural? Structurality comes from the idea that you have some kind of economic theory as the background idea for these two separate equations. We already discussed basically the structural assumptions regarding these parameter estimates. So at the end of the day, after you have been able to somehow figure out which of these equations that you estimate are the demand equations and which one is the supply equation, you should be able to somehow detect also these structural parameter values. Are they relevant in terms of the economic theory? Are the signs right or not? So the point here is that the price and quantity are determined simultaneously. Price affects quantity and quantity affects price. So it's very difficult to say that what kind of equation are you actually ending up after you have done, for example, OLS regressions. P and Q are hence here endogenous variables, and S and T are exogenous variables. Exogeneity means that you can define a set of relevant variables that has a role in defining the amount of demanded, and you can also define a set of relevant variables, in this case only one, in both cases actually, that has an effect on the supply. So the amount of supply is being affected by T, and the amount of demand is being affected by S. But we can obtain the so-called reduced form equations or reduced form structure for this overall model that corresponds to these two equations by solving first equation 4 and then equation 5 for P and Q. We do this separately. So when you start to solve these, when you first solve for the amount, the Q variable, you are able to get this kind of representation from the first equation, number 4, and this kind of equation from the second equation. So solve both these for Q, obviously, so you have the equations there ready. You don't have to do any maths here. Just plug in the assumption of equilibrium. Then you are solving this for Q. But the other thing is a bit more tedious, perhaps, not very difficult in this case either. But when you take into account that in these equations, you have this beta parameter in front of P, and in other equations, you have this Q, mu parameter in front of P. So when you try to solve the first equation for the P, or this equilibrium relationship for the P, then you obtain these kind of representations. So now you have to start trying to do the mathematical manipulations for this. So when you start to rearrange this equation 6, you have there a representation. You can build up a representation where you only have this P variable on the left-hand side. So move everything that is related to P, the price variable, move everything to left and every other items to the right. So the sign of this mu times P changes so when it comes to the left side, and also the signs of alpha and gamma times S plus U, they change also when they come to the right side. And then collect the common factors or the common multipliers inside the parentheses. So you are now moving towards a very simple representation actually for the price variable. Divide everything here on the right-hand side with the coefficient, the joint effect of beta and mu that is here in front of P. Divide everything that you have there on the right-hand side with this beta minus mu. And you can get now a representation for P. What is the relevant thing here now? What is the key thing here now that you are ending up? The key thing here is that now that for the first problematic, the first endogenous variable, you can now get a representation where you only have exogenous information on the right-hand side. No Qs here at all. And that was the main idea in doing these calculations. So first of all, in equation 8, you have some kind of constant term. This is based on the ideas of the constant terms, for example, in the first of all, in the actual starting structural equations, alpha and lambda are there. And in addition, alpha and lambda are being affected in this reduced form representation by the coefficients that are in front of P, beta minus mu. The second thing here is that, again, you have now ended up into a situation where you have the exogenous time series of T. In front of that, you have once again a parameter estimate that you can basically now estimate without simultaneity biases. So you have time series for P, T, and S. So you can estimate basically these parameter estimates that are based on the structural parameters. So as we remember, this is the K parameter or kappa parameter for the exogenous variable in the supply equation divided once again by beta minus mu. And the second guy here is the effect that comes from actually now the relevant information that is exogenous in the demand equation. So basically, obviously, both of these guys should have a role to the price. It's intuitively clear that if here these guys are in connection to the quantity and quantity is reflecting the changes in price, and also in this equation, if they are statistically significantly affecting the quantity, then obviously they also have an effect on the price. So it's only intuitively appealing to get this kind of result. And here actually you have a combination of error terms regarding the demand equation and the supply equation. V minus mu divided by beta minus mu. V minus u divided by beta minus mu. So basically now you should already have an idea that actually this is nice. I can use just simple OLS to estimate this equation. I would introduce a probably statistically different from zero constant term, and then information regarding the technology and the information regarding the substitute good Huawei phones prices, and much of things are obviously also being left unexplained. So we have an error term here. That is actually an error term that constitutes or includes also the structural errors that are based from the economic theory. So we can get a nice representation for price. This is good. You can do that. The only nasty thing here is that from the final parameter estimates that you get for this just using, for example, OLS. They are kind of a messy combinations of these structural parameters. So obviously, the only things that you would be able to do in terms of statistical analysis is to test for the significance of these things and the signs at the front of these. So basically, for example, there here actually we get the quite nice result that we have a theoretically negative parameter estimate on this, but the final parameter estimate actually depends highly on the actual values of these parameters in the structural representation of the model. Then, what about the Q? Are we able to do the same thing? Yes, we are. We are basically, when we multiply this equation number 7 by beta times mu, that is the relevant thing there. When we multiply it by this, then we can get rid of everything that has an effect on Q in the denominator of the Q representation. So when you multiply by beta times mu, then you are able to get this kind of representation. So we multiply equation 7 by beta times mu and start to manipulate this thing in a way that everything that we are interested about is concerning the big, the uppercase Q, so the quantity. So we can once again get all the things or all the items that are related to Q to the left-hand side. So we have once again here similar kind of representation at the final stage where we have only Q on with the coefficient of 1 on the left-hand side, and then we have these reduced form parameters on the right-hand side. And once again, we have these only exogenous variable explaining the quantity now. So these are something that you can actually estimate. You can estimate an equation for prices here when you have the data, time series data for prices, and you have the data for T, and you have the data for S. So you have data for the technological level or development, and then substitute prices. So you can also estimate the equation for the quantity. So this doesn't look very nice, and it does have some problems in terms of the final interpretation of the results, because especially this guy here is quite a messy guy. There's actually a non-linear effect here also, because you are multiplying B with kappa here in this case, beta with kappa. So basically you have in all these cases, you have actually some kind of non-linear effect from these parameter estimates. But the main thing here is that you can estimate this using standard OLS. You can get the price regression equation and you can get a quantity regression equation. And that is something that you always would like to get, because you have a unanimous interpretation for these parameters in this case. So these two equations, these final equations for prices and the second equation for quantities, they are denoted to be the so-called reduced form equations for prices and quantity. But what would happen if you had estimated the first equations, the structural equations 4 and 5, so them separately using OLS? In that case, you would have end up into a situation where your parameter estimates are biased, because you cannot say to which of the equations they are, especially for the price parameters, which one they are referring to. So you are violating the classical linear regression model. CLRM refers to classical linear regression model that we discussed about in the first week. So you are violating the standard assumptions, namely because one of the key assumptions is that the error term is not correlated with the explanatory information, the X variables. So expected value of this is 0. And in this case, it's not the case, because the information that you are using in the one equation is also included to an equation that you are using as an explanatory, or the information that you are using as a dependent variable in another equation. So it's clear from equation A that P is related to the errors in the structural form representation, so it's stochastic. And the main assumption is that it should not be stochastic. So what would be the consequences for this in terms of the standard ordinary least squares regressions for this beta? It would be the case that you get biased parameter estimates. So here are the equations for calculating the beta estimator, or the values for the beta, using this information that you have on the right-hand side and the left-hand side variable, and the starting regression model looks like this. So the beta hat, the beta estimate is based on this idea that you should not have here any kind of correlation. So it's clearly, it should be exogenous information that you are only using. So if the x's are non-stochastic, which means that this guy here would be zero, you would be considering probably a single equation system in that case, so that the expected value for the parameter estimate of beta is equally the sample beta value, and that is the condition for unbiasedness. But in this case, when you are violating this last condition here, actually, if that's part of another equation, the information in X is part of another equation, then you are actually violating this assumption that these should not be correlated error terms. So you are violating basically the multicollinearity assumption. So application of ordinary least squares regression to structural equation will lead to a biased coefficient estimates. If it's, is it even consistent to use that? In fact, it's not. So you should absolutely, if you have some kind of idea that you might have a multicollinearity problem in your system of equations, so one or more of the right-hand side variables in the in one equation can be left-hand side variable in some other equation, then you should actually take this into account in your estimation procedures. And this is actually in time series analysis, this is something that we very much try to capture using the vector autoregressive models. So basically it's not possible to estimate these kind of structural equations like 4 and 5 using OLS if you have these kind of multicollinearity problems in your data or in your equations. So what can we do? How are we able to sort of get rid of this problem with the data? In this example case that we are now considering here, we ended up into a situation with the equations 8 and 9 that we are able to estimate a price equation. So remember that this pi 1,0 is now capturing actually a set of many things. So it's capturing actually this guy here, lambda minus alpha divided beta minus mu. And then also the second parameter estimate in the reduced form regression, and the parameter estimate on S is also a combination of these structural form parameter estimates. So that is why we are referring these as the combination of various things. But the main thing here is that we can estimate these because we only have exogenous variables on the right-hand side. We don't anymore have Q here, or we don't have P here in equation 11. So we can use OLS since all the right-hand side variables are exogenous. So this is actually, this is obviously something that we should always try to aim towards in terms of the final equations that we are trying to estimate. Only exogenous or theoretically valid exogenous or predetermined information on the right-hand side. And the things that are determined based on our model should be left as the only information on the left-hand side. But we, and the problem in this final regression model, that is the reduced form regression model, is that we probably actually don't very much care about the values of these pi coefficients. But what we would like in terms of testing our economic theories, we would be interested about getting the original parameters in the structural equation. So alpha, beta, gamma, lambda, mu, and kappa. These things are the ones that we are actually interested about. So how can we do that? Basically, we can do that using partial analysis. So after we have obtained these parameter estimates, we can assume something about one set of structural parameters, and then based on the obtained values for these reduced form parameter estimates, we can calculate the structurally implied parameter estimates or the coefficients based on the actual values for pi 10, pi 11, pi 12, and so on. But you have to always assume something that the others stay the same. Otherwise, you are not able to, or they have some assumed values, you are otherwise not able to calculate anything from this, basically. So can we retrieve the original coefficients from these pi's? Sometimes. That is the short answer, actually. Sometimes we can retrieve those. But in many cases, it's actually requiring some very restrictive assumptions about some of these structural parameter estimates that they are not actually changing at all. So in some cases, it is possible to do that. And the other thing that we usually end up having in these simultaneous equation systems is the identification problem. So let's once again consider the supply equation and demand equation system. And as we already noted, it's basically impossible to say when you only have the data about this if you don't have any additional data. So now we are restricting actually this equation 12 to be the case supply that you don't have, for example, that technology variable here at all. And in the demand equation, you don't have that Huawei price variable here at all. It's completely impossible to say that which one of these is which one. So both equations are unidentified or not identified or under-identified. And the thing that is relevant here is that you don't have any kind of exogenous information here. You only have endogenous variables here, basically. So it's impossible to tell which one is demand and which one is for supply, if you don't have any additional information. So we don't have enough information from these equations to estimate the four parameter estimates unanimously. So in the original case, we didn't have this problem because we had some additional information revealing that which one of these is actually supply and which one of these is actually demand. So that's sort of we find out that actually this exogenous information is highly relevant. So obviously, in terms of time series analysis, it is obviously interesting if you have a set of variables, and basically any one of those variables can be either endogenous or exogenous variable, then the thing that you are interested about is that which are the exogenous variables and which are the endogenous variables, obviously. And this is something actually that the VAR, vector autoregressive analysis, has originally been designed to do, to help you in identification of the information, whether it's exogenous or endogenous. So basically, what determines whether an equation is identified or not? So an equation is identified in the case when we cannot get the structural coefficients from the reduced form estimates basically at all. And in case when it's exactly identified, we can get unique structural form coefficient parameter estimates. So we can get to a reduced form representation actually for the system of equations. And we can use that with certain assumptions to deduce, so the deduct the structural form parameter estimates, so the coefficients. And when we have an over-identified equation, then we will be discussing about this later. But this just means that we have a set of structural coefficients that we can obtain based from the reduced form. So there's basically too much information even to be used for the identification. So how do we tell if an equation is identified or not? There are two conditions that we can look at. First of all, we can use this so-called order condition that is a necessary but not sufficient condition for an equation to be identified. So basically this is defined in terms of the number of equations, how many equations you have, how many variables you have, which of those are endogenous and which of those can be considered to be exogenous. So after that, you can basically say that if an individual equation is identifiable or not. The second one here is the rank condition, and it refers to a situation that we will specify structural equations in a matrix forms and consider the rank of a coefficient matrix. This will be discussed in more details in co-integration analysis when we start doing the so-called Johansen procedure analysis for the co-integration of the time series. But let's go that to probably next week or at the end of tomorrow's lectures. So when we are using this order condition, it is something that is necessary. It's absolutely necessary for an individual equation to be identified or not. So the problem is that whether a certain equation, is it a demand equation or is it a supply equation? That's the identification. How can we say that it is something? It's reflecting something. So this is very simple. This is very old thing already, but it's the one that has been still proved to be the necessary condition for identification. If we denote G to be the number of structural equations, so these are the original theoretical equations that you are interested about. And by definition of Ramanathan, we say that equation is just identified if the number of variables excluded from an equation is G minus 1. And now you have to first remember here that we are talking about the actual conditioning information. So we are discussing about the variables. We are not discussing about the parameters. We are not discussing the coefficient about the parameter estimates, but we are discussing about the variables, the actual data. If more than G minus 1 are absent, it's over-identified. If less than G minus 1 are absent, it's not identified. So the first thing here is to first decide this relevant comparison value, which is the number of structural equations minus 1. And then take a look at the number of variables in each and every equation. So here we have an example of a system of equations, where on the left-hand side we have these y's. We have y1, y2, and y3. So they are based on our theory. We have decided that they are the endogenous variables. Then we have a set of conditioning information. X's are exogenous. Our theory says that they should be the things that have a role to explain. For example, excess return from an individual stock, it should be related to, first of all, excess return from the general market portfolio, and then it should be related to, for example, a term structure of interest rates. So that is a macro conditioning information. So we have here X1 and X2 resembling those observations. Now the question is that whether each equation is over, under, or just identified. So what can you say about the identification of this first equation, number 14. So this is 14, 15, and 16. First of all, what is g minus 1? Just open up a microphone and answer. What is g minus 1?
Two.
Yeah. And how many variables you have?
Two exogenous.
Yeah, but what about endogenous? They are also variables. So how many variables do you have together?
Five.
Yeah, and that's the thing that you're interested about. You're interested about the whole overall, the all information set, not just conditioning information. Conditioning exogenous information is the X set of X variables, but you have these endogenous variables also. So all of these are, they are variables. You can put them into an individual vector of variables. And this is actually basically the idea in the vector autoregressive models. We just allow from the beginning, we allow that all the variables might be endogenous. We are interested about the dynamics between those variables. How are the past observations of, let's say, for example, X1 affecting the current observation of Y1? How are the past observations of Y2 affecting also the current observations of Y1? But let's discuss about that a bit later. So what can you say about the identification of first equation? How many variables are being excluded from the whole set of variables in that equation? That's the relevant question.
None.
None. So is it over-identified or under-identified, which means it's not identified? Yes, it is not identified because the number of excluded variables is zero. What about the second? How many variables are excluded from the whole set of variables in the second equation? We don't have there this guy.
None.
No, in the second equation. Second equation is this one, y2 equals constant term plus beta 1 times y3 plus beta 2 times x1 and then error term. How many variables from the whole set of variables are excluded in that case?
Two.
Yes, correct. So what can you say about identification? Compare that to the value of g minus 1. G minus 1 was 3 minus 1, which equals 2. So 2 is 2. So we have an exactly identified equation there. What about the third one? How many variables are excluded from the third equation?
Three.
Yeah, so we have all the x's excluded and also the y1 is excluded from that one. So we have more than enough information. So it's over identified. Three is bigger than two. And this is the simple idea in the Ramanathan order condition, whether it gives you an idea whether you can estimate based on your data that you have for the variables. Are you able to estimate these parameter estimates that you have to estimate? And it is, in this case, it is actually possible. So here we have the solutions. If number of excluded variables equals 2, then the equation is just identified. And in this way, if it's bigger than 2, then it's over identified. And then if it's smaller than 2, then it's not identified at all. So 14 is not identified, 15 is just identified, and 16 is over identified. Then the thing that we are actually also very much interested in applying VAR models, and we have a very easy tool for that analysis in the form of so-called Granger causality tests, is this idea of exogeneity. We are interested about which of the variables are can be denoted to be clearly these X variables, and which are the endogenous variables. So how can we tell whether variables really need to be treated as endogenous or not? And once again, we have the same set of equations. And so we see here that equation 14, it has y2, y3, x1, and x2. So it has these y2 and y3, but do we really need equations for those? That's the key question. So we can formally test this using the so-called Hausmann test for exogeneity. This is the general test for a linear regression model system of equations. So this is calculated based on these additional regressions. So let's first just estimate. Let's take the data and estimate the reduced form equations corresponding to these equations 14 to 60. So we have data for 5 variables. Estimate these equation first, get these parameter estimates, and then estimate the second equation, get also parameter estimates for all those, and then estimate the third equation. The third equation might seem to be the most problematic because it only involves endogenous information. It only has Y2. It doesn't have any information from the predetermined or exogenous variables. It doesn't have X1 or it doesn't have X2. So let's now estimate those. So we can do that by this, recognizing from here that we have the exogenous information in the largest form of X variable, or the vector of X variables is the largest one in Y1, because we have here these two guys. We have problematic animals here, these Y2 and Y3, but these are nice guys that are actually giving us some kind of information that is relevant. Y2 is also something that is a bit problematic, but we have there actually this X1. So Y2 is being affected by exogenous information. This guy is a nasty thing here. It's also affected by Y3. So Y3 and Y2 are obviously interconnected based on this thing clearly. But when we have an equation for Y2 where we have this relevant exogenous conditioning information from X1, then obviously it is the case that for Y3 also this should be affecting. X1 has an effect because it has an effect on Y2, so it has to have an effect also on Y3. So basically, just using exogenous information, we can say that based on these equations 14 to 16, the first equation that skips all the endogenous problematic things there out looks like this. And the second equation looks like this. It has the X1. And third equation looks like this because there is this Y2 that is actually dependent on X1. So estimate these reduced form equations. They can be called to be reduced form equations because we only have there the exogenous variables. So obviously, if you estimate these guys, you get different parameter estimates for the constant terms, first of all, to Y2 and Y3, and for this pi 2,1 and pi 3,1. They are not the same, because the data on Y2 is different from Y3, even though the conditioning information is exactly the same. So let's estimate this using only exogenous information. Use just standard OLS and get the fitted values. So after you have estimated this regression model, you get the fitted values for this, and estimate this one, you get the fitted values for this, and estimate this one, you get the different fitted values for Y3, because Y2 and Y3 are different time series. They are different variables. They are not the same, even though here in the reduced form regression, the conditioning information is actually the same. But these guys here will not be the same, because these are not, by definition, these are actually not exactly the same time series. So run the regression corresponding to equation 14, and then run the regression 14 once again. So we are now next running this equation, this largest equation in the original system of equations. And then what we are doing next, run that same equation again, but now include the fitted value of these problematic guys, these endogenous guys. Because in the system of this equation, we had these not so nice guys included. So we first run this one without these fitted values, but then exactly the same equation, but add these fitted values from Y2 and Y3 regressions here. And then we do an F test to test the joint restriction that this additional information is not relevant. If the null hypothesis is rejected, then actually it gives us an information that this additional information, it is relevant. So they cannot be estimated as components of this equation for Y1. They are not exogenously determined. They are endogenous. So they have to have their own explanatory equations. Use just an F-test. Why F-test? Well, we are testing the joint significance of these two parameter estimates. So that's the reason why we use the F-test, because it's for testing multiple coefficients, significance of more than one coefficient. So we test the joint restriction that these fitted values for Y2 and Y3, they do not have any effect on the behavior of Y1. We refer to this, we use this superscript notation 1 to tell that they are included to this equation for Y1. Okay, so this is a very simple test. You can do that for any kind of simultaneous system of equations. But we have in time series analysis, we have actually even more sophisticated ways to do. You don't have to use this Hausmann type test, but for a system of equations where you have clearly a priori ideas about the clearly exogenous variables, you're sure based on the economic theory or financial theory that a one set of variables is clearly exogenous. So then you can obviously test for the exogeneity or endogeneity in this case of the rest of the variables. Are these actually endogenous or exogenous variables? But you have to have some kind of idea about clearly, truly exogenous variables. But in time series analysis, we actually have a test to testing for this exogeneity or weak exogeneity of any of the variables in the system. So that is something that we will be discussing shortly. So we have these possibility of recursive systems. What does a recursive system then mean? If we have this kind of representation for our data, once again, we have three endogenous variables and we have the conditioning exogenous set of variables as x1 and x2. In the equation for y2, we have one problematic guy actually. So this is actually resembles almost the equations 14 to 16, but we have some differences here. So for example, in the second equation, we have the effects from the first endogenous variable y1 and also the same conditioning information regarding the exogenous variables. In the last equation, we basically have the most serious problems in terms of endogeneity because we have these guys from the other equations also as explanatory variables in that regression model. But let's assume that, nevertheless, we can estimate these individual equations in a way that these error terms, U1, U2, and U3, they are not correlated with each other. So basically, it should be the case that Y2 is not also correlated with U1, and Y3 is not correlated with U1, and also Y1 is not correlated with either of these, and Y2 is not correlated with these. So it means that now the question is that can we estimate the equations individually using OLS? I think that to all of you now, the first equation, it should be quite clear, because we have here assumed that the standard OLS regression assumptions hold, so we don't have multicollinearity problems here, so x's are not correlated with the U1, so the expected value of x information of x1 times u1 is 0. The same applies to the second exogenous variable x2. So we can actually estimate that equation using just simple OLS. What about second equation? Basically, the thing that you have to focus, there is a nice part in terms of clearly exogenous information. We have these x's there still. So in the second equation, the problematic guy here is the y1, because it's actually included here. But the main thing here is that actually the right-hand side variables in these equations are uncorrelated with that equation's error term, and Y1 is not correlated with this. So Y1 is not correlated with the U2, even though it's included here. So there's no Y2 term in this first equation, so that gives you the reason why it's not correlated with Y1 is not correlated with U2, so the second error term here. So we can once again use OLS on this equation also. What about the last system? It has the same conditioning information regarding the exogenous variables X1 and X2, but in addition, it has also these previous guys. Equation 22, left-hand side variable, and 21, left-hand side variable. So it does have these Y1 and Y2. But the main idea is just, or the main requirement is that these guys are not correlated with U2. So based on this similar argumentation that we used for the previous case, we can actually say that equations 22 and 22 are not containing this Y3. So we can use, once again, ordinary least squares regression for this case. This is known as a recursive or triangular system. We do not have a simultaneity problem here. What is the main reason for finding this kind of result compared to, for example, this system of equations that we have here? Why is this not a recursive or triangular system of equations compared to this one? What is the main reason there?
We can solve the latter one so that we have only one endogenous variable and only one equation.
Yeah, exactly. So basically the thing that helps us in solving this is that we have this exogenous information in each and every equation, basically. So that is actually something that is very useful here. So if you are not willing to use VAR models, you have a clear economic or financial theory behind your system of equations. So you have to take into account these possibilities that are you able to estimate the final, structural parameters from the recursive parameter estimates? Are you able to deduct those at all? And you should actually be able to use a recursive or triangular system in your final regression, so in order to be able to do that. So we don't have this simultaneity problem in this kind of representation at all. So the main idea is actually that you should include also the exogenous information to each and every equation that you are considering in your system. But in time series analysis, we actually very rarely have a possibility to get this kind of recursive system or triangular system. So it's the smaller is your system and the more you have clearly exogenous variables in your system, the better are your possibilities to do that. But in financial applications and also macroeconomic applications, we in many cases have a situation where we cannot actually determine that what comes first, what is the egg and what is the hen, basically. So it's not possible to say that by definition, we can clearly say that this certain variable should be on the right-hand side variable, and it is not being affected by the endogenous or the left-hand side variables at all. And the main reason for this comes from the characteristics of time series data. They have long memories. So the past values, the AR modeling that we discussed last week is the key here. That actually gives you an idea that it's perhaps not very easy to get these kind of recursive or triangular systems because the analyzed variables or the analyzed time series, they usually have a fairly long memory. So the past observations do have an effect on the current observations. So basically, this dynamics between these systems or these variables actually might be the key interesting thing to be revealed. And can you use that dynamics or the representation of the dynamics, can you use that for the purposes of revealing the exogeneity characteristics of the data? Which of the variables are can be considered to be clearly exogenous with respect to the other variables? So this is the next thing that we will now start digging deeper. So the by far the most useful or most generally used system of equation in all kind of time series analysis is this VAR model. So if you have a set of time series observations for more than at least two variables, then in addition to doing simple OLS regressions based on your economic theory, so you have an idea of what would be the left-hand side, what it should be based on theory, and what would you have to have on the right-hand side, then obviously always also the possibility that what if the dynamics of the left-hand side variable actually are very relevant in determining the past values have an effect on the right-hand side variable also. So this is just a simple idea of VAR models. And this comes from the idea that these data series in time series frequencies, they usually are, current observations are strongly affected by the past, the nearest past, and a bit further history in back of the observations. So this is the VAR model. It's just an generalization of the individual or the univariate time series models, AR models. So V here refers to the vector of variables. Vector autoregressive models refers to a situation where we are applying AR type, autoregressive type analysis to the vector of variables. Autoregressive resembles the idea that the history has a relevance. So the past observations do have a role. You would just have to be able to somehow determine the relevant history, how long history from the past, how big number of observations in terms of the history you have to take into account. So it is always easiest to start from a simple bivariate var, which means that we have an information set of Y1 and Y2. So we have time series, for example, for Nokia returns, and we have time series for Neste returns, for example. Y1 is the Nokia returns, and Y2 is the Neste returns. These can be obviously excess returns also. Usually I prefer always analysis using excess returns because that gives us an idea about the role of capital asset pricing model. That also gives us an idea about the relevant information at the right-hand side for these guys, for this individual firm assets or their returns. So the main idea in VAR modeling is that, first of all, based on the AR property of Nokia returns, it's obvious that the Nokia returns at the moment, let's say this week's returns, are being affected by the last week's returns of Nokia. And even 2 weeks from the past, or 3 weeks from the past, or 4 weeks from the past, even 52 weeks from the past might have an effect on current weekly observations of Nokia returns. But the VAR model allows that for some reason or other, the Nokia returns might be also affected by the Neste returns. So the second variable here is Y2 is Neste returns. And Neste returns from the last week might have a role to do in explaining current returns from Nokia, and Neste returns from 2 weeks past in the history, and from more and more from the past history might have a role to play there. So basically, this is just referring to the case that, yes, Neste returns have a role to play in defining, or the past returns of Neste have a role to play in defining current observations of Nokia returns. But we have no reason to believe that Neste returns would not be affected by Nokia returns. So we are admitting that also the Neste returns have this memory characteristic. So the AR part of the Neste returns comes obvious here, up until weeks K from the back history, up until perhaps 52 weeks, it might be relevant to include. But we admit that because Nokia returns are perhaps affected by Neste returns, then also Nokia returns might be affecting Neste returns. And the thing that we are interested here is that which one of these guys is more relevant to the other one? Is it really the fact that the Neste returns are affecting Nokia returns, or is it just only the fact that the Nokia returns actually are affecting Neste returns? And this is the main idea. But we are now allowing this dynamic structure in these dependencies between these variables. But the main idea here is still that we want to apply very simple linear regression models. So we want to assume that in a good model, when we have estimated the best possible representation for the dynamic dependency between the variables, we have nicely behaving error terms here. So first of all, these guys here, they are not correlated. So the expected value, when we multiply the observations of U1 with observations of U2, expected value should be zero. And the expected value of individual error terms, it should also be zero. This comes from the need for us to use the simplest possible regression modeling, which is OLS regression always. And one of the starting assumptions for that is that the model is good enough to produce this kind of behavior in the residuals. So the residuals have an expected value that is zero. And more importantly, actually, if we are able to capture the relevant dynamics, we have captured all the relevant dynamics, the consecutive observations of these error terms should not be correlated. So we have been able to take care of all the relevant dynamics in the representation, the parametric representation of the model. We can obviously analyze a bigger set of variables. We can include more, let's say, OMAX stock returns, like, for example, Kone and other things. But you have to remember here that immediately when you increase the number of observations, you run into the problems very, very soon in terms of the degrees of freedom. So unless you have very much observations in your data, don't try to increase the setting or the vector of variables to be too big. Obviously, in many cases, the vector of variables that you should be analyzing is more or less dictated by the theory. What is the relevant set of variables that you are interested in? The main thing in terms of reducing the size of the model then is to try to get to the parsimonious representation in terms of the dynamics. So try to get to the shortest possible representation of in terms of the number of lags that you include to the model. Because in many cases, the theory says you the relevant variables that you would be interested in doing your analysis. For example, in that example that we have been using in these lectures regarding that paper of mine for the forecasting exercise of real economic activity in the future. If we were to use a VAR model, then we would have this real activity measure and then the short-term interest rate, perhaps, but not necessarily because it proved to be not perhaps necessary in based on the OLS analysis. So we would have the excess return from the stock markets and the term spread. So only three variables in the VAR model. And then try to somehow determine the best possible lag structure in the system of equations between three variables. That would be the main target of your VAR analysis. So perhaps we can have now a 10 minutes break. It's 15:30. My computer clock is 15:30. So let's continue 15:40. Let's have a 5 minutes break here. 10 minutes break, sorry. So I just pause recording. Okay, so let's continue now from the VAR models. So first some notations and concepts. As I already mentioned a couple of minutes ago, in many cases these VAR models easily get to be very large models, but it is actually very easy to give them in a very compact representation of the models because we can use these vector and matrix notations for these models. So let's assume the shortest possible lag structure in this case, for example, which means that we have only one lagged effects for the first variable and also the one lagged effects for the second variable. The key thing here for you to remember that the fundamental representation of the VAR model is always the one where you have only the lagged effects of the Y1 and lagged effects of the Y2 in the first equation. And the same here for the second variable, we have the lagged effects of itself and lagged effects of the other variable. So we don't have in the fundamental representation of the VAR model, we don't have the contemporaneous observations, but I will show you that it is actually possible to get to this representation also from the case where we have these contemporaneous effects, because our theory might be actually saying that it's not relevant actually to include only the past history, but also the current observations of, for example, Y2 are relevant in determining the values for Y1. So we will be going through that example too. But nevertheless, in other cases, we have the possibility to give this that gets easily to be very complicated representation if you have plenty of variables and plenty of lags. And this soon gets to be a mess, even though I personally like to have this written open in this form, because I actually get a more clear idea about the relevance of the variables also there. But you can write this in a simple vector notation. So just define the vector of variables that you are analyzing for the current observations on the left-hand side. You have a vector of constant terms. So this gets to be estimated a different level parameter estimate compared to the beta 2, 0 in the second equation. And then this matrix of coefficients for the lagged effects. So beta 1, 1 is the coefficient that's reflecting the effects of Y1 from the past, and alpha 1, 1 is reflecting the effects of Y2. And in the second equation, when we write this open, you have alpha 2, 1 multiplied by Y y1 t minus 1 plus beta 2 1 multiplied by y2 t minus 1. And then a vector of error terms. And you can even write this even more compact way just by giving this as a vector notation where you have the vector yt here. Perhaps you should use bold letters or something to indicate a bar here, for example, that you are discussing about the vector of variables. But nevertheless, the dimension of the vector is g times 1. So you have g endogenous variables whose observations from the period t, current observations you are trying to explain by a set of constants. So each and every equation for the variable y's do have a separate constant term, and then the effects of the lagged values of each and every variable yt that you are considering. So this matrix has a dimension of a g times g, and this vector is g times one vector, and obviously the residual vector or the error term vector is also g times one. The main idea in all the modeling of VAR models is once again to try to get to a representation of the data in the form that results into a well-behaving U terms for each and every equation. So expected values for both these guys would be zero. They should have a constant variance. They should not be autocorrelated. So you have taken care of all the dynamics by including enough observations regarding the lagged values. So there, the number of lags is big enough to take care of the autocorrelation problems in this error term in each and every equation. So basically, right from this idea, you should actually get now the idea that perhaps it's once again about the minimization of the information criteria. Because information criteria is based on the number of observations, number of parameters that you have to estimate, and the residual sum of squares. So residual sums, the sums of squares for these values. Try to minimize that in a multivariate setting, then you are able to get to the best possible representation of the data. Surprisingly enough, in most of the VAR models that are being applied to macro data and financial market data also, we actually are able to get to a fairly short lag lengths in the models. In most of the cases, VAR1, at least for a macro data, is usually enough. And also for financial market data, in many cases, you will be seeing in the demonstrations that the lag structures are not very long. And this is something that is very different compared, for example, to the ARMA models that we discussed last week, because in many cases, ARMA models have to be hugely parameterized to get the best possible representations of the data in terms of the goodness of fit of the models. So basically, VAR modeling is actually a bit easier in that sense that it's not so much of an ad hoc choice what is the lag length, the relevant lag length in the models. In many cases, it's not very long, actually. So this model can be extended to the case where there are k lags of each variable in each equation. So obviously, in that case, it's just defining the k is now defining the lag length structure in the model. And we can also extend this representation to the case where the model includes first difference terms and co-integration relationships. This is something that we will be discussing probably tomorrow already. So this is just a vector error correction model. It's basically a VAR model where you have also introduced in addition to the VAR representation for the differences of the variables, you have introduced also a co-integration relationship for the levels of the variables. So the linear relationship between the variables defines, or the levels relationship between the variables defines the long-term equilibrium relationship. We will be discussing about that. But basically, this actually now gives you an idea, similar kind of modeling procedures or statistics can be calculated also from vector error correction models because they are based on basically VAR models that we will be discussing today. Vector autoregressive models compared with structural equation models. We discussed about the problems in the structural equation models last time. What are the advantages compared to those when you use a VAR model? You don't have to a priori specify which variables are the endogenous or which are exogenous. And this is actually the main advantage of the VAR model. You start from the idea that you let the data dictate completely which of the variables really are endogenous and which are exogenous. There are so-called also structural VAR models that actually are being used based on the theory that for a set of variables, they should absolutely be considered as exogenous variables. So you can impose restrictions for those variables when you estimate the effects of the rest of the variables in terms of their dynamics. So these are so-called structural VAR models. And they are actually heavily used in, for example, macroeconometric analysis, in analyzing larger macroeconomic models, but not perhaps so much in financial applications. In most of the financial applications, we actually have to more or less assume that we might have these simultaneous relationships or dependencies in terms of the dynamics between the variables, so that we are not clearly able to say that which of the variables is clearly an exogenous and which ones are endogenous. So we have to start from the idea that anyone can be endogenous, or all the variables can be endogenous, and the historical of observations or the past or the dynamic structure between the variables is the relevant thing to be revealed from your data. So these VAR models, they allow for the value of a variable to depend on more than just its own lags or combinations of white noise terms. So this is referring to the ARMA models that we discussed last week. So it's a bit more general than the simple univariate ARMA modeling. If we have a case where there's no contemporaneous terms on the right-hand side of the equations, we can simply use OLS separately on each equation. Because it should be the case that for each and every one, the relevant lag structure is enough to produce a series for the residuals that is behaving correctly or in an appropriate way in terms of OLS regression requirements. Forecasts from VAR models are often better than traditional structural models. And this is the other advantage, big advantage of VAR models. So if you end up in using some kind of structural econometric model, for example, for macro data, you should always allow for the possibility that the imposed structural restrictions between the parameter estimates that are based on your original structural model, and you impose those to the reduced form regression of your model, they might not be actually holding if you allow for more richer dynamics between the variables. So you have to allow for the possibility that you would perhaps have to model those relationships between the variables using VAR models. One of the things that has been highly criticized among the users of VAR models or towards the user of VAR models is that they are clearly atheoretical. Atheoretical means that you a priori don't have to have even a theory. But this is something that I very much am against of this argument, because obviously based already from the construction of the set of variables that are included to the vector of variables that you are analyzing in your VAR model, you should have an idea about the theory. What really are the relevant variables? You cannot just pick up, let's say, weather conditions and GDP development and let's say term structure of interest rates or anything like that to a vector if you don't have a some kind of model, theoretical model for those. And the other problem with VR models that has been often raised up is the how do you decide the appropriate lag length? Well, we have basically tools for this question. So basically the main idea here is that in terms of the parsimony of the model, the more you have variables and the more you have lags of each and every variable, the more you have parameter estimates to be estimated. So the less you have observations, the more unreliable are all the parameter estimates, because the degrees of freedoms gets to be used, the bigger is your model in terms in comparison to the number of your observations. So basically, for example, if we have three variables, like for example in that forecasting exercise that I am being using in as an example here in lectures, and the lag length would seem to be three, relevant lag length would seem to be three. So we have to estimate for each and every variable a three-variable system that contains lag values of each and every one up to the lag length of three. In addition, also the constant terms. So the number of estimated parameters is 30. So for example, if the overall number of observation is only, let's say you have 60 observations, so you have 5 years of monthly data, then the degrees of freedom is actually very, very, let's say, is questionable, because you end up using so much data for estimation of these parameters. So it's actually might be ending up into a situation where you're not able to rely on your parameter estimates in terms of their standard deviation. So they may be biased. They are not efficiently estimated. Do we need to ensure all the components of the VAR to be stationary? Yes. This is a question that has only one answer. We have to ensure that all the components of the VAR model are stationary. If any of those is not stationary, then it actually mixes up the interpretation or the statistical inference of the parameter estimates. The simple metric for this is to take difference from the difference values for the problematic variable. We will be discussing about this tomorrow. How do we interpret the coefficients? And this is now referring to the coefficients on the lagged values. Do we have a theory that would say that, for example, 2 months lagged values of excess returns would be having an effect on the 12-month change in the real economic activity in the euro area? No, we don't have any kind of theory that would say, dictate basically that it's exactly the 2 months value that should 2 months lagged values that should have an effect. So basically, the interpretation of the coefficient is even not necessary in the VAR models. Don't even try to interpret those unless you are using some form of structural VAR models where you have imposed some kind of restrictions for a certain set of variables. For example, that the contemporaneous effects are zero and the first lags are something based on the theory. But that is something different, that it's now structural VAR model. And for the estimation of the parameter estimates, you have to more or less generate those from a distribution that implies these restrictions. So it's not an unrestricted VAR model from a start. So my advice to you is, the first time users of VAR models, is that don't pay attention to the individual parameter estimates or the coefficients of the model basically at all. They are not the necessary things, but pay a lot of attention to the building up of the lag structure. What is the relevant lag structure first? And then do the interpretation in terms of the impulse responses and variance decompositions that we will be discussing shortly. So the first step is always to choose the optimal lag length. How many lags do you want to include to your model? And we can use basically two approaches to solve this question. First one is to do the decision based on these cross-equation restrictions. What does a cross-equation restriction mean? It means that you impose a restriction for the unnecessary lax in each and every equation. So when you estimate an unrestricted VAR model, you are estimating the, for example, for a bivariate system of variables, you are estimating a VAR model with 8 lax. It means that in each equation, first of all, you should have the same lag length. So for the first variable, you have 8 lax, and also for the second variable, you have 8 lax in the equation for the first variable. If you have also a constant term, then you have there basically 17 parameter estimates to be estimated. 8 plus 8 plus 1. And we want to examine, for example, that is a shorter model, is it enough? So the same thing for the second equation, you have also there the same lag structure, so you have to estimate 8 lax parameter estimates for the 8 individual lax for the first variable and also for the second variable and the constant term. And we want to examine a restriction whether the lax from 5 to 8 are necessary or not in this system for both equations, basically. And this can be done using a likelihood ratio test. So likelihood ratio test is something that probably most of you have never heard, but it's very easy to calculate immediately when you understand the ideas of OLS regression. If you denote the variance-covariance matrix of residuals from a model that you have estimated, let's denote it by U times U vector of observations and the transpose of that of observations divided by the number of all observations. Let's denote it by sigma hat. The likelihood ratio test is by definition calculated based on calculating the same sigma hat from the restricted model, and the restricted model means here that in both these equations, you restrict the lags from 5 to 8 to be 0. So 5, 6, 7, and 8, so 4 lags in the first equation and 4 lags in the second equation, they are restricted to be 0. And estimate that. So estimate that only with 4 lags for both. And then the second variance-covariance matrix of residuals is based on the unrestricted. Unrestricted means that estimate the total model where you have all the 8 lags for both of these variables. Calculate the difference between the log values of the determinants of these. You don't have to calculate nowadays anything by hand. The machines and programs produce everything. You just have to use the right option depending on the program, that they will report you the determinants of the restricted and the determinant of the unrestricted variance-covariance matrix of the residuals. Calculate the difference of the log values between those, multiply that by the number of observations. That is the definition for the likelihood ratio test. And you get the result whether the restrictions or null hypothesis is that the smaller model is valid. So the restrictions are holding. So the test statistic is asymptotically distributed as chi-squared with degrees of freedom equal to the number of restrictions. So in the VAR case where we have two variables and we are restricting 4 lags of the variables, both variables in each of the two equations to be 0. So we have a total of 4 times 2 times 2 restrictions. So we are considering in both equations for both variables the lags from 5 to 8. So in the first equation, we have 8 restricted parameter estimates to be 0. And in the second equation, the same thing. 8 plus 8 is 16. So in the general case where we have a VAR with P equations and we want to impose the restriction that the last Q lags have zero coefficients, there would be P to the square times Q restrictions altogether. in many cases, in this case, for the construction of this test equation, this test statistics, it is usual perhaps to write out or open the matrix or the vector representation of the model so that you can clearly pinpoint the, which ones are the parameter estimates that you are now restricting to be zero at the first trials when you try to analyze a VR model. There's a disadvantage. It's actually got labors to do. It's cumbersome and requires a normality assumption for the disturbances. And this is actually something that is actually, well, it usually gets to be reported in some of the programs, but don't use this as the only criteria for choosing the lag length, because it can actually give you in some cases, actually a wrong idea about the lag structure. Use always also at least two of these. And these are just multivariate generalizations of the information criteria for AR models that we discussed last week. So these are the vector generalizations of the information criteria. So the first one here is the multivariate Akaike information criteria. Once again, it's based on the model's variance covariance matrix for the residuals and the number of parameters to be estimated from the model and the number of observations. The same thing here for the Bayesian Schwarz information criteria. SBIC refers to the Schwarz Bayesian information criteria and the multivariate case for that. Once again, the first thing here is the estimated variance covariance matrix for the residuals, but the other things that are relevant are the number of parameter estimates and the number of observations. And this is the Hannan-Quinn generalization in the multivariate case for the information criteria. Once again, the same guys here, but in each and every one in a bit different penalty effects for the part of the parameter estimates, number of parameter estimates. So all the notations are as above, and this K dot is the total number of regressors in all equations, which will be equal to G to the power of 2 times K plus G for G equations. So you have G variables there plus a constant term in each equation. So basically, these are the guys that you should be always using. If you make a decision using this likelihood ratio test, so you are using cross-equation restrictions, in addition, take a look at the information criteria also. Try to get the minimum value for these and use at least two of these. In most cases, actually, it will be the result that these information criteria are referring to the same lag structure. It's not so questionable in most cases than it is for the ARMA models. And especially if you get the same indication from the likelihood ratio test, then obviously you can be very sure that the optimal lag length is the one that is being indicated by the information criteria. So far, we have assumed that the VAR is clearly kind of a primitive or the starting form where we have only the lagged effects of each and every variable that we are analyzing in each and every equation. But what if for some reason or other, let's say that the economic theory is saying that it is actually required to have take a look at also of the contemporaneous effects, which means that we have the current observations of Y2 having here an effect on the Y1, and the same thing here in the equation for Y2, the current observations of Y1. So the contemporaneous current observations of Y1 are having an effect on Y2 also. Can we do this, or can we analyze this using the VR representation? Well, basically, we can do that. We can write this as this kind of representation in the vector or matrix form. So this var is actually kind of a called the primitive form of the VR representation, and we are now imposing here also the role of the cross effects in terms of the contemporaneous representations. So we can take the contemporaneous terms to the left-hand side. The key to do the analysis using these VR representations is basically kind of a same kind of modification of the model as we did in the case of obtaining the reduced form representation from the structural representations in the last hours or the previous slides that we have discussed. So basically now you can do the analysis based on using only the lagged observations of the vector variables on the right hand side, but you do not have the basically the coefficient on one. So you don't only have one times y1t here for the effects on the y1. You also have minus alpha times 1,2 times y2. So yt is reacting simultaneously with the y2 with the adaptation coefficient of alpha 1,2 to the lag values of these same variables. So it's not one. The coefficient on y1 is not one like it was in the previous case, because there's also the simultaneous effect on the y2 that has to be taken into account. And basically in the equation for y2, where you have a coefficient for y2 of one, you also have to take into account that simultaneously y1 is being also affected at the same time. But we can then pre-multiply both sides by this B to the minus one matrix to give the representation. So this is basically doing same kind of manipulation operation that we did for the to obtain the reduced form regression, reduced form representation of the system of equations earlier. So you can estimate now these alphas. And this is known as the standard form VAR, which we can estimate using OLS. But in this case, it's actually not so relevant to go back to this to discuss about the reduced form role of the reduced form parameter estimates in defining the structural form parameter estimates, because we are all about all the things that we're interested about is the dynamics between the variables. So basically, we can do these kind of analysis also. So we can add the contemporaneous terms. In addition to this, we can actually also include some clearly exogenous variables. But we would, in that case, we would have to have some kind of idea based on either the economic theory or financial theory or some a priori information that perhaps something that is completely exogenous to both of these guys, if we are considering a two-variable system, something that is affecting to both of these guys, let's say unexpectedly. Like for example, for financial market variables, it might be relevant to take into account that, for example, the corona crisis has affected to the behavior of central banks in a way that they have expanded their balance sheets hugely after March. And this has been an exogenous thing that the markets have not been able to forecast. First of all, the corona crisis, even though basically the central bank reactions might have been forecastable beforehand, but they should have an effect on the excess returns or risk measures in the markets. So we can add those kind of things, perhaps for a, let's say a model where we have an excess return for S&P 500 and an excess return for stocks 600 from the European markets. And we estimate the VAR model for those. And we can include the contemporaneous effects from central bank balance sheet extensions from both US market or the Federal Reserve or and the ECB to this VAR model for the for the returns from the stock markets. So that would be an exogenous shock. We are assuming that actually they are not reacting primarily to these stock market developments, so they are exogenous. And we are interested about their contemporaneous effects also. So we would be estimating a model for these two stock market returns separately, only them without these exogenous variables, and then a model where we have these exogenous variables. Let's take a look at the impulse responses and variance compositions from these two models and compare those. So that is an example of purely exogenous information. So I already briefly actually indicated that the relevant things that we are interested in the case of using VAR models are not the actual parameter estimates that are being estimated. So for example, in case we have here a bivariate model, so we have Y1 and Y2 are the variables that we're interested at, and we estimate a lag length VAR with a lag length of 3 at the maximum. So we have first the constant terms for both equations and then the effects of Y1 at first lag and then effects of Y1 at second lag and also the effects of Y2 at first lag and the effects of Y2 at second lag and then also the effects at third lag of both of these guys. The same thing here for the Y2. So obviously you see that already from this very fairly small model, we have lots of parameters here that are to be estimated. In addition to the constant term, we have now 6 actual parameter estimates to be estimated in both equations. So the primary thing here is that it is even not necessary to pay too much attention to these individual parameter estimates. They are just the things you will get statistical significance for some of these, but probably not necessarily for all of these in both equations. But nevertheless, it might be relevant that you actually include to this equation for the second variable, you include the 1 period lags from the first variable and also the, let's say, the 3rd period lagged of the first variable. So these are there, but the 2nd period lags might not be so important, but nevertheless, you have to include the possibility that Y1 is being affected by the 2nd period lags of this Y2. So there is a simultaneous relationship between these two variables. And we might be interested in testing the following hypothesis. We are not so interested about testing whether this is statistically significant and this is statistically significant and this is statistically significant or not. But we are interested about the joint effects of all the dynamics in the variable number 2 for the behavior of variable number 1, Y1. And in addition, we are interested whether its own history is also relevant. And in the 2nd equation, we might be interested that is it the case that Y1 is actually causing, in historical terms, the current observations of Y2. Whereas, for example, the history of Y2 is not so relevant. So we are interested in testing these kind of hypotheses. So these are so-called block significance. We are not interested about the individual parameter estimates. We are merely interested about the block significance. Block significance refers to the role of the variables, their history in terms of determining the observations for the other variable in total. So we are interested about null hypothesis, whether lags of Y1 do not explain. So we always, like is the usual case in all statistical testing, that we impose the bad things basically to the null hypothesis. So we are interested whether the Y2 has a role to play in determining the Y1 values in historical terms or not. So we are imposing as a null hypothesis that the lacks of why one are not explaining current observations of y2. So the implied restrictions for this equation looks like this. Beta 2-1 and gamma 2-1 and sigma 2-1 are all together zero. So this is a joint test. So this is an F-type test once again, because we are testing a number of restrictions, more than just one parameter restriction. So we are testing here three restrictions. The second possibility is that whether lacks of y1 do not explain current observations of that itself. So y1. So implied restrictions would look like this. So basically we are now restricting here this one, and we are restricting here this one, and we are restricting here this one. They are restricted to be zero. Third possibility is to consider whether the lacks of y2 do not explain current observations of y1. And the last one is whether the own information has role or not. Each of these are F-tests, or we are using F-tests to test all these joint hypotheses. And because each of these restrictions contains only parameters drawn from one equation. So basically, we are now using a joint test for many parameter estimates. And in many cases, we are actually talking about so-called Granger causality tests. So here, the null hypothesis is that the y1 is not Granger causing y2. And here, the y2 is not Granger causing y1. So in terms of Granger causality, the cases 1 and 3 are the relevant ones. So we are considering the cross correlations or cross causality between the variables. So Granger causality tests seek to answer questions such as, do changes in y1 cause changes in y2? If they cause, should be the lacks of y1 should be significant. And this is something that you have to be careful here, because you are not talking here about theoretical causality or theoretical causality relationships. You are talking about, by definition, so-called Granger causality. And this has been first defined in the Engle and Granger paper in Econometrica in 1987. So be careful here, because some of the people that are within our own discipline, for example, are not so big fans of time series analysis at all. They always want to point out that this is just based on past history. Well, yeah, it is based on past history, but past history might be relevant. So that is actually very important to analyze. So if you end up into a situation where both sets of lacks are significant, then there is actually bidirectional causality. So everything is affecting to everything, actually, in terms of the dynamics or the dynamic effects. You might end up actually into these kind of situations. But nevertheless, you can do the inferences based on testing using these F statistics. VR models are often difficult to interpret, and so basically the thing that we are utilizing from these representations is actually these impulse responses and variance decompositions, which means that, first of all, the impulse responses trace out the responsiveness of the dependent variables in the VR model to shocks to the error term. So basically, if there comes a shock to this one in this equation, then how is this variable reacting to that shock? The main thing here is that after we have estimated the Vieira model, we have certain dependencies, first of all, from the first period lagged observations of that same variable, and also from the second variable, first period lagged observations. So if there comes a shock in this guy, obviously, right from the next period onwards, it will have an effect also on the behavior of y2. Similarly, if there comes a shock to this second error term here. Right after the next period onwards, it will have an effect also on the behavior of Y1, because these are in connection to each other in this dynamic representation. The bigger is the, are the parameter estimates on each of these lagged effects, and the more statistically they are statistically they are important, the more or the bigger are the effects also in terms of these responses. So consider, for example, this bivariate case: a change in U1 will immediately change Y1, and it will change from the next period onwards also the Y2. And the same thing comes through the changes in U2. So basically, the thing that we are interested here is that how long do the shocks have an effect on an individual variable, and when do they vanish, and what are the signs of the effects actually? That's the other thing that we are interested in. Are they negative in the very short term, and do they change to, let's say, positive? And actually, the economic theory is the one that should give us an idea of which kind of signs do we have for the impulse responses, for example. The second guy here is the variance decomposition. So these two, actually, these two measures are the ones that you will be utilizing from your VAR estimations, actually, most frequently. Variance decompositions offer a slightly different method of examining VAR dynamics. They give the proportion of the moments in the dependent variables that are due to their own shocks versus shocks in the other variables. How big percentage share of the nearer term variation in the variable that you are discussing about, how big percentage of that variation is explained by its own shocks compared to the shocks from the other ones. So the more permanent the variable is, the bigger should be the shock effects from its own history, and the more exogenous it is. So this is actually giving you also an idea about the exogeneity of the variable. So this is done by determining how much of the S-step ahead forecast error variance for each variant variable is explained by the innovations to each exponential variable. So it gives us information about the relative importance of each of the shocks to the variables in percentage terms in the VAR. And one thing to be remembered or noted from these impulse responses and variance decompositions is the ordering of the variables in the VAR model. The ordering means that what is the variable that is giving as the first variable in the vector of variables. And the main idea here is, first of all, resembling actually the need for some kind of economic theory as a background to even construct the vector of variables. The main idea in terms of the so-called Cholesky orthogonalization of or ordering of the variables is that the most exogenously assumed variable should be the first one. And in terms of decreasing degree of exogeneity, you should introduce the variables to the VAR model. So the most exogenous one should be the first one. And for example, in that lecture example that I have been using, it might be actually relevant if you are including an EPU, economic policy uncertainty variable, that we also included with user in the actual article. That should be considered perhaps the most exogenous variable, especially if you are analyzing, for example, that forecasting equation for euro area, then, for example, the economic policy uncertainty from US is something that it probably doesn't very much react to the euro area funds and market variables or euro area real activity, not very much. So it's the most exogenous of the variables. If you include to the set of variables the US EPU and then the excess return from the euro markets and the short term spread from the euro markets and the real activity measure from the euro markets, then the US EPU is the first in your vector of vector autoregressive model, vector of variables. So it's actually quite important to at least consider some kind of alternative orderings. And the one that is most frequently used in these analyses is that you, from a theory or some kind of a priori ideas, you get an idea for the exogeneity or the decreasing order of exogeneity of the variables in a VR model. And as an alternative, estimate the same model by using a completely reversed ordering and examine whether the results are sensitive to that, because it might be the case that they are sensitive to that, because the error terms are usually not completely without correlation between each other. The error terms are usually correlated at least to a degree, not very much, but they might be at least somewhat correlated. So this is actually, in that case, it's actually relevant to consider what is the ordering, what can be assumed to be the most exogenous variable. And finally here, we will go quickly through a practical example. So this is not based on now my paper with user, but this is based on a more, let's say fundamental or more on expanded example. But the idea is once again the same, actually, that we want to analyze the interaction between financial markets and in this case property firm markets returns and the macroeconomy. And Brooks and Solakos actually employ it, this was in the journal Real Estate Research or something like that. They use this VR methodology to investigate the interaction between the UK property market and various macroeconomic variables. So the property market means that they actually analyze here the excess returns or the returns from property market related firms, a portfolio of firms that are related to the property markets, their returns minus the general market index returns. So basically kind of excess returns, but it's not defined based on the risk-free interest rate, but it's something in excess of the market returns. So they are using monthly data for December 1985 to January 1998, and they assume that stock returns are related to macroeconomic and business conditions. So basically, they don't have a very sophisticated theory behind this. Just based on previous literature, they are able to say that it has been found that there is an interesting set of variables that might be explaining these property market returns. So in the VAR model, they have first of all these FTSE property total return index with general stock market effects removed, means that they calculate these return index returns minus the market portfolio returns from the UK. Then they have this macroeconomic variable. They also have monthly data on unemployment rate, nominal interest rates, spread between the long-term and short-term interest rate, and I think that this was 10-year rate minus 3 months rate, unanticipated inflation. This is actually the unanticipated inflation series is generated based on the same idea that I presented actually last week in terms in connection to the ARMA models that I used in my PhD thesis. They also use an ARMA model to forecast the future inflation, and then they generate the forecasts from that, and then they calculate the difference between the forecasts minus the actual inflation, and that is the unanticipated inflation. To generate these variables, they actually had to do a lot of prior work before they could get the relevant series to be analyzed. One of the interesting variables that I'm also very much interested in is this dividend yield. And they are analyzing the dividend yield for this property total return index, not to the general index. First thing that they do is to start from taking a look at the descriptive statistics, and tomorrow we will be discussing about this I1 feature of the data series in more details. So they find out that the property index return and unemployment rate are I1, which means that they are non-stationary. So they are unit root processes. And the simple solution for that, because all the other ones were not non-stationary, so they had to use differenced values for these two variables. So they did this first. Then they started to do their analysis. And you have the short run interest rate, SIRDE, dividend yield, spread, unemployment, unexpected inflation, and the property market portfolio returns there. And they are reporting here the marginal significance levels associated with joint F-test that all 14 lacs have not explanatory power for that particular equation in the VAR. So they started from the using of 14 lacs, so huge model. So there are basically, if you have a constant term, 6 times 14 lacs means that you have 84 parameter estimates plus a constant term in each and every equation. So lots of dynamics. It's not worth to take a look at any of the individual parameter estimates, but based on the demonstrations that you have now gone through in this course, what can you say about the lag structures or the dynamic effects? Which are the variables that would seem to be reacting to the lagged values of the other variables? Let's say that we will be making inference at the 5% significance level. So the dependent variable, left-hand side, Y variable is always here. You get the result here that, first of all, short-term interest rate is really strongly reacting to its own lags, even at 14 lags. So what can you say about other variables? Does any other variable, do any other variables have an effect on the short-term interest rate at 5% significance level?
Don't they all?
Well, almost every other, but we have one variable that doesn't seem to be affecting. Which one?
Unexpected inflation.
Oh, yeah.
This one here is not affecting, but at 5% significance level, we can say that short-term interest rate is definitely dependent on almost anything else. What about the dividend yield?
It's not affected by the other tax.
Yeah, exactly. What about the property market returns? Are they reacting to anything? That's the last one here, property market returns.
No, they are not.
Yeah, no, they are not. But basically, the interesting thing is that it is actually the case that the property market returns do have an effect on something, and actually quite strong effect on the interest markets, interest yielding asset markets, because they have a short-term interest rate effect here, and they also have an effect on the spread. So interest yielding asset markets are actually reacting to the property excess returns from the property markets. This is the first thing that you have to do always. Do these significance levels for the parameter estimates in the VAR model. Then the next step here is the variance decomposition for the property sector index residuals. Ordering for variance decompositions and impulse responses goes like this. In the first case, we assume that the property returns might be exogenous to all the others, most exogenous to all the others. And in the second case, we do the analysis in vice versa ordering. So the most endogenous are, in this case, the short-term interest rate and the spread. So what can you say about these results? Do you see any kind of effects from the between the variables? This is variance decomposition for the property sector index residuals. So from the whole estimation of the VAR model, we are now focusing on the effects of all these other variables on the property returns. So what can you say about the reactions of the property market returns? Are they reacting to anything else? First of all, is it relevant to do these analysis in these two orderings? Do the results change very much?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, and what is the main result that you get?
If we use the first order, then the other variables don't have any effect. But if we use the second order, the dividend might have some effect at least.
Yeah, exactly. So the two most important variables that have an effect on the property returns, when you assume that is the most endogenous, so that is reacting to all the others the most strongly. So in that case, dividend yield and spread, actually, they might have a role to do there. That is actually quite important. Together, they explain 47% of the variation in the property returns. And that is actually quite big, because the rest of the variation is being explained by the property returns themselves, basically. There's only 0.2%, 0.7%, and 0.8% here for the other variables. So these two guys, dividend yield and spread, together actually explain quite a lot of the variation in the property returns. You were not able to get this kind of result from the simple F tests for the significance of the individual parameter estimates. So it is actually now revealing something. It's not completely irrelevant, actually. So it is actually something that the property market research might be reacting to the other variables, at least to agree. And here we see the impulse responses based on the same model and standard error bands. These are generated by Monte Carlo simulations in the actual paper for innovations in dividend yield and the treasury bill yield. So how do these property returns react to the innovations in dividend yields and the treasury bill yield? So we actually see here now, we did it for these relevant things here. So it seems to be now that we do have some kind of reactions. So basically, the main conclusions are that simply based on the VAR estimation of the model, if we were not to do more, let's say, deeper analysis using variance decompositions and impulse responses, we would not have been able to say basically almost anything. But from actually these analysis, we do get some interesting results. So based on these results, it would seem to be the case that the property market returns are actually reacting to a set of certain macroeconomic variables, not nearly all of those, but those that are perhaps most related to the general stock market development. You have to remember here one thing, and what is the thing that you have to remember here actually? How did you construct these property market returns? Actually, Brooks and Tolakos actually do not discuss very much about this thing, but what might be one of the explanations actually well, no, actually it's not the case, because they are calculating the dividend yields. I remember this wrong day. I remember that they would have calculated the dividend yield for the general index, but no, they calculated that for the property returns. So it's not, there's not a constructed variable problem here. So basically it's really a result that is actually relevant in terms of, for example, a standard dividend discount model, because this guy here seems to be a relevant factor in explaining the returns of these stocks, and also the interest spread is also relevant there. Okay, so basically, if you, even though you end up this kind of table or this kind of results from your significance tests for the individual parameter estimates or the sets of parameter estimates for the variables, don't leave it there, because in the variance decompositions and the impulse response analysis, you might get something interesting out of those. So do these always. My message to you is, when you are using VR models, do always also variance decomposition and impulse response analysis. Okay, does anyone have any questions? No. So let's continue tomorrow from the unit tests. So we will be moving on towards a analysis of non-stationary time series tomorrow. And take a look at that printout from the tests of Unitrude, that example number 5 that I have already downloaded to the Moodle. Take a look at that so we can discuss quite smoothly about the results tomorrow after we have covered those things, these Unitrude test ideas in the Unitrude tests first. Okay, thanks for joining me, and have a nice evening, and see you tomorrow at 9:15.